Hello and welcome to Seven Pillars. This is a new podcast where we interview a guest about the things that they like and love, influences on them from different fields, music or literature or food. We're looking for seven things that have shaped them or inspired them or influenced them. I'm Alan Davis, I'll be the host each time, and for the first ever edition of Seven Pillars, our guest is the West Country's finest, Josh Widdicombe. How are you, Josh?
I'm good, thanks, Alan. Well, as we both know, I'm absolutely sweltering. It's kind of the hottest day of the year as we record.
It is the hottest day of the year, where your headphones, your earbud might become as one with your ear.
I'll become part man, part podcast.
Right, let's crack on. These are things that have all, not just things that you love and like, but somehow they've had an influence on you or made you think about yourself or the world or music or literature. And we'll start with your book that you've chosen, which is Fever Pitch by Nick Hornby. It's a book I love, of course, because It's about a life as an Arsenal supporter. And you've chosen in particular a chapter about Gus Caesar. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so I realised like Fever Pitch for someone of my age and kind of demographic is a cliched choice, I suppose. But I think there's almost an element of it changed so much and so much got shaped by it that it now seems like a cliche because of so many of the things it created. You know how like when the Strokes came along, it felt very exciting. And then about 4 years later, there was so much bad music that sounded like the Strokes that the Strokes themselves sounded worse, if you know what I mean. And so I think in a way, Nick Hornby's kind of tarred with the brush of everything that wasn't as good as him that followed. And so it was kind of a book I read in the mid-90s, I suppose. It would have been a couple of years after it came out. I would have been about 13, 14 probably when I read it.
I was going to say, you were quite young when this came out. Were you born in 83, is that right?
83, yeah. So when did this come out? 92?
This 91? Came out in 92, yeah.
I didn't read it straight away. I didn't read it straight away. I presume it must have come to you straight away as a kind of absolute gift.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's hard to find a good football book, really. But this is a book more than just football, is it? It's a book about his life. It's about childhood and broken home and divorce.
Exactly. And I think it's about obsession, you know. And it's about obsession and it's about dealing with who you are. The reason I haven't chosen the book as a whole, but I've chosen the chapter about Gus Caesar, who I've never seen as a footballer. I've never seen him play, but due to this chapter, he operates this huge kind of part of my thoughts on ambition and life. And I reckon if you Google Nick Hornby, Gus Caesar, the chapter is like on some website that'll come up as the first thing. And I reckon I read it often to someone when I'm drunk about once every 2 months.
So Gus Caesar, for people who've never heard of him, he was an Arsenal player for a brief period of time. And then after an accident-prone period in the first team, he left the club and never really attained the same heights again. And he in particular made a catastrophic error in the League Cup final in 1988, which led to an equalising goal when Arsenal were on the way to winning the cup. And in the book, Nick Hornby talks about how he must have been the best player in his school. He must have been one of the best players in his district. He must have been. And then he's in the Arsenal team. Then he's in England under 21 squad. And it all seems to be going well. And yet he falls short.
It's a section about kind of believing in yourself and how little that is worth. And I always think that's such a... I know this sounds so negative, but he kind of draws a parallel and he does say, you know, sport and the arts aren't analogous, he says in it. He says, you know, there is no such thing as a brilliant footballer who's never been found because the scouting network is kind of foolproof. There's no such thing as a sprinter who can run under 10 seconds who isn't at the Olympics. But he draws the parallel that when he started writing, he believed in himself and he thought, I'm good, so I'll make it. And he basically says that Gus Caesar is a kind of, not a metaphor, a symbol maybe, of how... however much you believe in yourself or however much the things tell you that this is inevitably going to happen is not necessarily the case and it's not true. And he kind of at the end of the chapter says you trust that feeling with your life and it's worth nothing. And I just really like that drawing. I mean, I'm kind of obsessed with sporting metaphor. I'd happily draw everything to a sporting metaphor. So I'm a kind of sucker for it. I think too often we see people who are successful tell you that all you've got to do is like believe in yourself and try and you'll get there. And I think that's a terrible message to give to our children. Because there's a lot of chance you weren't.
He talks about the book called The Hustler by Walter Tevis, which became a film. And there was a part in the book where someone... And Nick Hormis said he wrote these words and typed them on a piece of paper, put it above his desk. That's what the whole goddamn thing is. You've got to commit yourself to the life you picked. And you picked it. Most people don't even do that. You're smart and you're young and you've got, like I said before, talent. And then the next line is... As the rejection slips piled up, these words comforted me. But he put those up as an inspiration. You've got talent, surely it'll be all right. But as Gus Caesar found, and Nick Hornby found, until Fever Pitch, that isn't the case.
Exactly. There's at the end, I just want to read a bit which kind of sums it up, where he says, Gus must have known he was good, just as any pop band who's ever played the marquee know they're destined for Madison Square Garden and NME front cover. Just as any writer who has sent a completed manuscript to Faber and Faber knows he is only 2 years away from the Booker. You trust that feeling with your life. You feel the strength and determination it gives you, coursing through your veins like heroin, and it doesn't mean anything at all.
Well, you know this is true from the world of stand-up comedy, don't you? Because everybody knows someone who gets the odd gig here and there, or maybe still doing open spots after 5 years, and they cannot understand why Michael McIntyre's doing so well and they're not.
I mean, it's just... the lesson that you should sell your life to something is... going all in, it just feels like such a big thing, and I don't think it should be the taught... principle of life. And I suppose this argues against that, and that's not just like, oh, your whole life, but it's like, I think it's a really good thing to bear in mind with every project you do or everything you do. So you'll be writing a new thing or you'll be working on a new thing and you'll go, this is the best thing I've ever done, and then it's not good, and there'll be another thing that you'll think, ah, this is a bit shit, and then it's really good. And it's almost like you are the worst judge of your own merits and self, I think. Do you know what I mean?
I think it's certainly true that if you think you're doing good work, you're in trouble.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
I do remember working on a BBC One sitcom in 1999 or something like that, and the writer came in one day and he said he'd seen The Rushes, and he said to me, I smell BAFTAs. Well, the red carpet was untroubled by the cast of that show. There was no need for any silver polish.
I think all of the best comedians that I know are beset by self-doubt, and that's what makes you better. I think self-doubt should be taught in school as something that's actually very useful.
I played at a charity game, the Arsenal Ex-Professionals and Celebrity 11, has been going for years and years and years, and Gus Caesar was playing.
Yeah.
And... I played it right... This is 2004 or something. I mean, the idea of me going on a full-size football pitch now is laughable. But I played at right midfield, and Gus Caesar played behind me at right back. And he went on an overlapping run at one point at such speed that I've never seen anyone run so fast in my life. And I think that might be perhaps the thing that got Gus to where he got to. He was astonishingly fast. He went all the way up the other end, and then he turned around and yelled at me to go back and cover because he had to walk back. And then I looked across and Andy Linnigan was giving me positional advice, which I certainly took. I remember going for a loose ball and Anders Limpar was on the other team, and he left his foot in and caught me on the top of the foot. And the next day, my foot had swollen up so much I couldn't get my shoe on. And I realised that I'd been nobbled by Anders Limpar. It's the least violent footballer we ever had. So we'll leave that there. That's a really nice thing to pick, that. There's something quite inspirational about that. And the rest of the book, of course, is well worth reading if you haven't read Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch. It really is a brilliant book. Well, Josh, we'll move on from there. We'll move on to somebody else with the Liverpool connection. What a smooth segue. It's effortless. You've chosen for your performance, so we're asking people to come up with an event. It could be anything. It could be a sporting event or a performance or something they were at that really stayed with them and had a profound effect. And you've chosen Paul McCartney at Glastonbury in 2004. before.
Yes, I have. I thought about sporting events because I was going to choose the cricket. I went to the Cricket World Cup final, the Ben Stokes final, which is probably the greatest sporting event I've ever been to. But I don't think I learned, do you know, I don't think it stuck with me in any other than going, I can't believe I was there. Whereas I think the experience of kind of seeing a Beatle, I found that kind of transcendently different from any other musician you could possibly see, if you know what I mean. I actually saw David Bowie at Glastonbury in 2000 or 99, whichever one that was. And that was amazing. But I think the reason the Beatles mean so much more to me than people like David Bowie or the Rolling Stones or any other kind of peers is I just think their story tells so much more than any other band. They represent so many kind of stories of bands that have come since. They represent the whole of the 60s. And the fact that you had four people that came together, or certainly three who were so talented, who, you know, came together by chance and changed the world, I just think is by far the greatest story in pop music ever. And I think the fact Paul McCartney is still gigging, and he's still gigging now, he's going to do Glastonbury this year. And I find that kind of, I think Paul McCartney is a much derided figure, but I actually find him quite kind of inspirational in that he just likes playing live music. He's not doing it for the money. He's not trying to pay off an ex-wife. He just loves to play live. And he loves to play these songs that he wrote in the 60s and 70s mainly. He plays a few new ones which aren't as good. But I find him kind of inspiring in that way, that despite the fact he's one of the two people in the who kind of led the greatest band of all time, he just likes gigging. He just likes playing music.
And was this a main stage, last thing, headline act kind of an event, a really huge crowd?
So he played the Pyramid Stage and he closed the Pyramid Stage on the Saturday night. And I think I've been to Glastonbury because I'm from the West Country, so I started going when I was at like sick form. And then I've gone intermittently for the last 20 years, I suppose. And going to Glastonbury is an amazing experience. It's like no other festival in that it just... I think there's a lot to be said for... And I'm sure you'll know this as a performer yourself, Alan. You'll see acts on tour, right? And we've done tours. And there's some nights that mean so much more to you than other nights for various reasons. Like London, obviously, is always a... feels like a bigger event because you've got people in and you know... Or Plymouth, for me, feels like a big deal and you want to do well. And other nights, you do as good a show, but it doesn't mean as much to you. And I always feel when you see an act at Glastonbury, this must be the important gig that they've had in their diary all year. This is the one that means something to them. They're not closing Reading for £1 million. They're there because they want to do it and it means a lot to them. And so I think seeing a headliner at Glastonbury that you actually want to see is a very special experience, and there's kind of no... better way to watch a band.
Yeah, it's a fantastic place. I've only been to the Glastonbury Festival once, and it was in 1994, and at the time I was working on Radio 1, or as it was known for a little while, 1FM, and we were up doing a comedy show at night, so we had the end list, the night list, and so all these bands that we'd never heard of. So there was a couple of those that I wanted to see in a little side tent away somewhere. One was on at 2 o'clock. One was on at 5 o'clock, I think. So we went to see one of these bands. They're great. I'm starving hungry. I'll go and get some chips. I come back and watch the other band. Brilliant. In between those two bands, the set that I missed was Oasis. Playing in a little tent at 4 in the afternoon. The next year, they were headlining the main stage. And I didn't get to see Oasis until... And this really was an extraordinary event. It was at 98, I think, at Main Road, Manchester.
Oh, wow.
And everybody, 38,000 tickets went in 2 hours. Everybody in the stadium knew every word to every song.
Yeah.
At one point, the Gallagher brothers had an argument and Liam stormed off. And the crowd, that was the highlight of the night for
the
crowd.
Yeah, that's what we come for, right?
And of course, they're hugely influenced, obviously, by the Beatles. Mm. Big picture of John Lennon comes up. And then Liam comes back on with a... massive joint and sits on the drum riser and is on the screen and the whole place cheering. It was a very memorable thing, but it was a few years after that I was asked to do a documentary or present a documentary about John Lennon. I don't know why they asked me, but it was a great privilege to do.
I remember seeing that.
It was a very interesting experience. Yeah. I found my mum died when I was young, and this happened to him, and I found quite a few little things in the story that I could relate to. And anyway, I listened to a lot of their music, obviously, to get ready to do this thing. And as I listened to album after album and listened to them again, I thought, well, that sounds like that band, and that sounds like that band. And that's, and then you realise that all bands post-Beatles sound like the Beatles. The influence is really extraordinary.
They changed everything. And the period between kind of 1966 and 1970, I mean, in their lifetime of 63 to 70, they did like 12 albums, which is unheard. Now you've got, you know, bands will take, if a band did albums in consecutive years, they'd be considered astonishingly productive. But they were just bashing out these great, great albums. And the evolution from 63 to 70 is like no other band. And I just think seeing Paul McCartney, what is he now? He must be 75, whatever he is. I just think it's kind of amazing that he's still going, he's still playing these songs. People go, oh, Paul McCartney, he's a bit embarrassing, isn't he? And it's like, yeah, but he's in his 70s. You know, that's all right, isn't it?
And he does still talk a bit like a hippie from the 60s.
Yeah, he does.
He does still use some of that language. It's a bit outdated.
Well, I remember at Glastonbury, he said, it was like, at one point, it was a rainy year, and he was like, can we rock in wellies? Yeah, we can. And you're like, oh, come on, Paul, mate. He's not cool. He's not cool, which is mad to say. But I think if you've been the most famous man in the world since 1963, if you're not the biggest dick in the world, then you should consider that an achievement. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that he's not an appalling human being is a pretty big achievement.
Yeah. Well, you were there. You saw a living legend.
Yeah.
And it stayed with you. I can imagine it would.
It really did.
Now, I want to take you to Pembrokeshire, because we ask our guests to think of a place that's special to them, as places means a lot, or has influenced them, or has affected them, or has an emotional connection. And yours is Pembrokeshire. Well, you went, I'm told, on your childhood holidays.
So every year we'd go on holiday to Pembrokeshire. I don't know if you've been. Have you been to Pembrokeshire?
I know Pembrokeshire because I was, in fact, a couple of years ago, went to Tenby. And, yes, South Wales, southwest corner of Wales, isn't it? Very beautiful.
It's unbelievably beautiful. I think it's, you know, got the most beautiful beaches in Europe, which is not me saying something for effect, but it's like genuinely, it's a startlingly beautiful place of yellow beaches and rocks and stuff. But really, it was where we went on family holidays. So we'd go on the same family holiday every year. We were kind of creatures of habit.
How many in your family?
So it's kind of, that's a grey area, Alan. So.
Well, it is the West Country.
So there was me, my dad and my mum. But then my dad had four children by his first marriage. So I've got two half-brothers, two half-sisters.
I see.
So this would be when they'd come, or some of them would come. They're all older than me, obviously, because they were by the first marriage. It would be insane if I was in the middle. And so they'd come. So it was kind of, I grew up kind of as an only child to some extent, but on another extent, they were my brothers and sisters that didn't live with me. And so it was a period of time for 2 weeks a year where I wasn't an only child in that sense. So it was great in that respect. I was very close to my older brother, Henry. He's about 3.5 years old. He's 3.5 years older than me. And so we'd kind of hang out, which we didn't get to do enough, obviously, because we lived in different parts. They live in Cornwall, we lived in Devon, which, as you know, is a hugely different world. And
doubtless you feel quite superior to them.
Yeah, of course. But you've got to let these people have a chance, Alan. We'd go on these holidays and we'd kind of do the same things every year. I suppose some people might go, that's a bit unambitious and boring, but I kind of love that. I kind of thrived on the repetition and the tradition and the doing the same things and having the same day. And that kind of then becomes almost a bigger memory of your childhood than if you went to France once or if you went to whatever. It kind of became this kind of, I suppose in the way that, you know, Christmas, every family has their own traditions for Christmas, and you repeat the same things every year in an attempt to kind of recapture that same feeling of family warmth and kind of, you know, repetition. And I suppose our holidays were a similar kind of attempt to do that. Do you know what I mean? An attempt to just live the same thing as you grew up year on year. And it was a kind of very happy experience.
Children like things that repeat. We did that. We had that great day. Let's do that again.
Yeah.
You want to go there again? You want to read that book again? You want to watch that program again? You want to go to that beach again? Yeah, it was great. Why don't we just do that again? They can't actually understand why they don't have the same meal every day. But we like that meal. That meal's great.
Yeah.
And you do build up a kind of a kind of thickened memory bank if you keep doing those things.
Totally. That's exactly what it becomes. It's just a kind of comfort of the repetition and the kind of doing something again and again.
And would you camp or would you caravan or was it hotels?
Yeah, so we'd camp, which now I just don't want to sound like totally, or I just couldn't do that now. I'd hate it.
So it would be two or three tents, quite a lot.
So we had one of those big tents where you'd have my parents on one side and then me and Henry would have you'd have like the compartments and then the kind of foyer, I suppose. Yeah, and then we maybe have another couple of tents, but you know, you're on a campsite where it's, what is it then, those days, £7 a tent a night, and you have to walk up to the showers that are, you know, showering at a parochial football club, I suppose, and like, you know, and they're outdoor toilets and stuff, but you don't care when you're a kid. Now I probably would, you know, I've been spoiled.
Well, now you can Airbnb, can't you? That's what we did in Tenby. Yeah, we found a cottage for rent.
Exactly. And you've got all your cutlery and you don't have to eat out of plastic and stuff. But at the time, I loved camping. I actually, bizarrely, got asked to do a feature for Countryfile because I think they approached me because they thought I was going to want to talk about Devon and they wanted me to go to a kind of place that mattered to me. So I said, I'd quite like to go back to Pembrokeshire for the first time in years. And they kind of took me back and they were like, so we're going to camp on the same campsite. And I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, really?
I didn't like it that much.
Yeah, all right. Can we just film it and then go to a hotel?
There's a place in near Tenby where there are water lilies and lakes and you have to walk quite a long way to get to a beach. What's that place
called? So that's the Bosherston Lily Ponds that lead to Broadhaven Beach.
That's it.
Yeah.
So beautiful. Amazing. My kids just loved it.
Yeah.
And little bridges and you keep going for miles and miles. And
it's like nowhere else. And, you know, I think obviously partly one of the reasons West Wales and Cornwall are so beautifully untouched is obviously they're the furthest away from the rest of the country. So obviously if that was in Norfolk, it would be absolutely rammed. But it does feel like, for want of a less cliche, it feels like a bit of a secret. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't feel like, you're like, how is this not more well known as this amazing area of the country? And I genuinely don't know why we started going there. It's not like we haven't got any connection to it or anything. We just started going there and got stuck in a rut. And so I can remember different things happening that are years apart. Like, I remember listening to Everything I Do It For You by Bryan Adams there, which would have been, I think, 91. But then I remember being there. I remember, like, having the CD. And I remember I was there when Be Here Now, the Oasis album, came out, because I bought it on the day of release in Pembroke. And that would have been 1997. And so I was, like, these things that are miles apart have all melded into one memory, which, like, sums up a decade of my life. But it's kind of summed up by the repetition of doing all these same things. Like, we'd literally live the same day every day. We'd go into Pembroke in the same morning, and then we'd always go to the arcade, and we'd play on the arcade machines that would slightly change every year, and when we'd come back the next year and they weren't the same, we'd be absolutely livid. And then we'd go to the beach in the afternoon, and it was so ticking off these experiences again and again. I don't know whether my parents were like, this is boring, but like, they certainly put up with our...
Well, you do know that if the kids are happy, they're fine. And if the kids can amuse themselves,
yeah,
they're fine with it. And then when you're all asleep, doubtless they drank themselves stupid. Well, that's wonderful. Pembrokeshire, it is gorgeous. The risk always, of course, with Wales is it will rain at some point.
Yeah. But there's a glory to camping in the wet, isn't there? That's the one time when camping is kind of wonderful.
It's heroic.
Yeah, that kind of feeling of being in a tent with the rain on it, except at Glastonbury.
I never did much camping, although I did when I was 16. I went with three friends on three motorbikes, and I went on the back of one of their bikes to Silverstone for the British Motorcycle Grand Prix.
Mm.
And we go to Silverstone, and we put the three bikes into kind of three sides of a square, and all we had was a fly sheet. I don't know what we were thinking. We put the fly sheet over the three bikes, and the four of us lay underneath them. I don't think we even had sleeping bags. We were very ill-equipped, but we were teenagers.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a monsoon
that night.
And that was monsoon. And no one seemed to care. I mean, people were mudsliding along on their bellies, and the river was, there's a river of water running down the country lane near to where we were. We were wet through. And the next morning, the sun came out, and we kind of got dry enough and went and watched the race. And then we got lost on the way home and ended up on the M25 construction site. That was a memory I stayed with.
I camped at Glastonbury, obviously camped at Glastonbury every year, but like the year, I think it was 2007 when it was like the worst rain of all time. And so I was in a field that was on a hill and we were about halfway up and it had been dry the day before. And the part reason that makes it even worse, because obviously the ground was dry, so it couldn't even take the kind of water. And so we were kind of halfway up the hill and then you looked, woke up and it felt like we had, were on a waterbed with water streaming underneath the tent. Got out and there was tents at the bottom of the field where you could literally see like just the top of the tent poking out of this river. And you were just like, it was just, it was like nothing I've ever seen.
It's a write-off. Leave it, it's a write-off. Yeah. We'll say it's been stolen. We'll create a claim. I can't imagine the carnage cleaning up after that.
Oh, God.
On a good year. Well, that's lovely to hear about Pembrokeshire. It does sound like somewhere that's been profoundly meaningful to you. Let's move on to music. You've chosen as an album, we asked people to pick an album or a collection of music, and you've chosen Quiet is the New Loud by Kings of Convenience, which I've been listening to on your behalf for the last few days, and it's mellowed me right out. Tell me about this.
It really does mellow you out. I wouldn't say it's like a great example of what I listen to, but I kind of, you know, in terms of albums that you'd come back to in the same mood every time, I think being kind of wistful and melancholic is kind of my favourite mood to kind of luxuriate in, if you know what I mean.
Now, Kings of Convenience, you might have to tell people a bit about them, because
they're a kind of a folk guitar duo who kind of
from Norway. They're a Norwegian guitar duo.
But
they do a kind of almost a spoken word approach to music.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I'm gonna go as far as say they're my favourite Norwegian guitar duo. Obviously, if you take the word guitar out of it, I don't know a ha from Norway. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
It seems to be quite a lot of wry humour in some of the lyrics. Would that be fair?
There's lots of nice little turns of phrase. There's a kind of, the one that like jumps out to me is like there's a bit about him kind of walking down the street in the rain, and the line is using the Guardian as a shield against the rain, which it creates a lovely image, obviously, of the Guardian when it used to be, you know, a primarily a print newspaper being used against the rain. Also, I think it's a lovely kind of question as to how a Norwegian has, I mean, I don't know whether they've been told by some A&R man to anglicise their lyrics so that they've removed the Norwegian newspaper from this.
The Haugenblad. Yeah.
That's not going to sell any in London if you say that. Yeah.
Now, when did you come across this? What age were you, do you think you were, when you came across them?
I was about 20, actually, yeah. So it would have been about year two or three in first or second year of uni. No, second or third year of uni when I was living in Manchester. And it was a time when there was lots of great guitar music around. I kind of spoke earlier, as I mentioned earlier, like that kind of period after the Strokes had broken, when there was lots of kind of really good angular post-punk style bands that came out of that, which I was really into. But this just, it didn't really sound, this was not like other things I listened to. And one of the things about it is I struggle with folk when it gets to the kind of Laura Marling, Joni Mitchell end of it, where Seth Lakeman or something, where it feels like it's folk in the way where you'd hear it in a Cornish pub, is not what I'm into. And this feels like you've got that softness and that wistfulness of the acoustic guitar, but with a more kind of wry Norwegian mindset, which I quite like. And I think because I don't listen to a lot of music like it, and I'm not a big folk fan, whenever I want to listen to something like that, I kind of default to it. If you know what I mean?
Do you associate a particular house that you lived in, or place where you were, or someone you broke up with? This sounds like you listen to this music alone, I would have thought.
Yeah, it would be a weird album to
have sex to. You wouldn't have sex to it, would you?
Do you know, thinking
It's not a Shaggy record, is it?
No, I'm going to disappoint
you. It's not like a Blaxploitation compilation.
It's more of a kind of Foreplay Going Nowhere record than anything else, isn't it?
It's a record you put on when you crash the car. It's the dead of night and you're waiting for the rescue services to get to you.
Do you know what? Do you know what it is? What record it is, Alan? It's when you've had like a bad gig and you're on a train home and your train's delayed and it's 11:30 and you're thinking, what am I doing with my life? It's that kind of record.
I don't imagine you have many bad gigs, Josh Whitaker.
Oh, well.
You find a way out of it. You just pull out the cash machine routine and just bring it back. Turn that ship around.
I think I just come back to it a lot because it's what I listen to when I'm feeling a bit down, but like wanting to luxuriate in it, I suppose. And I think it's kind of... The second album they did after that wasn't as good, and then they kind of, Erland Oy, the kind of main guy, did some solo stuff, but I've never, it's not like a band that means loads to me, but it's just an album that maybe hit me at the right time when I didn't really listen to anything like that, and so I'd keep returning to it. And conversely, kind of, just when, I think when you're 20 and you listen to music, it means so much more to you than when you're 37 and you listen to music, because everything you listen to when you're 37 is referencing something else. So you there's nothing new to listen to when you're 37, if you know what I mean. And so nothing's ever going to be... You know how they say, like, drug addicts are always chasing that first hit and they never have it again? I kind of feel like that's the same with music, isn't it? It's never going to feel the same.
I certainly think that if you ask people... I wrote a book about 10 years ago about my influences in my teens and early 20s. Mm. I think if you ask most people, what's your favourite book or film or album? It'd be something they came upon in that period of their life. As you say, when things were new to you and you would change your favourite band or favourite film every 2 weeks and then something becomes set.
Yeah.
These are the things I like and I've done that now. I'm not researching anymore.
Yeah. I'm complete.
I'm like, this is my favourite record and that's that. Yeah. I've been a bit like that with The Jam. I had a brief moment in 1994 with Bare Naked Ladies, who suddenly usurped The Jam.
Oh, really?
Because, yeah, they had more jokes.
That's slightly more... it's a bit more of a laugh than Paul Weller.
Weller's not known for his repartee. Oh, well, that's lovely. Well, that's Quiet as the New Loud by Kings of Convenience, which Josh has chosen for his favourite collection of music. Let's move on to food. Josh, we ask people, is there a food stuff or a particular meal or a place where you go to eat that means something for you? Where are you with food?
I've chosen...
Not Cornish pasties.
No, I'm not chosen Cornish pasties. I could have chosen cream tea, actually. I regret my choice now. But I've chosen... I think what I wrote down was getting an Indian takeaway when I'm hungover, which is just my favourite thing to do possible.
Is there, it's no better moment, though, is there, than when it arrives?
Oh, no.
And you're getting it from the front door to the kitchen.
Oh.
And then it's downhill, really, from then. And you end up just eating the poppadom.
Yeah, of course. It's so much better in theory. And you end up, what you end up doing is having a discussion about whether you should put all these kind of three quarters of a kind of tin dish into your fridge. And you don't.
People said, what's that one taste like? Well, the same as that one. Same as that one. But it's all good, though, is it? It's a good solid 6 out of 10.
Oh, yeah. Is the dial thick enough? Yeah, good. But I love it. I think one of the things is, if people say, do you know what? I've got a 2.5-year-old daughter, and people say, what do you miss? Do you miss, like, going out or whatever when you're parenting, when you're now a parent? And the thing I miss the most is being able to enjoy a hangover. So, like, I used to, and I didn't realise, obviously, that that was in any way a luxury until now. But, like, so prior to this, you know, you could go out and you'd just feel terrible. You'd feel terrible in the day. And you'd go on the Sunday or whatever, and you'd be fine with it. You didn't mind wasting the day. You'd watch 2 Premier League matches. You'd kind of do stuff badly. You'd have a nap, and you'd find it funny how bad you felt, and then you'd have a curry. And now you kind of, you're forced to, obviously, parent for the day after you've been out.
Well, the first few hours of parenting, you're still drunk, aren't you?
Yes.
What happens is, as you get further into life, you can hold more and more drinks. So by the time you're in your time of life, your hangover doesn't really kick in till about 3 in the afternoon. by which time you've done 7 or 8 hours of parenting.
But this is the problem with it. It's like, people think, can you get a babysitter for the hours when you're out? That's not when you need the babysitter. The babysitter you need is the next day. Like, I almost prefer to take my child out on the piss and then...
So hangover police. That would be quite a good business. Yeah. We'll come around. Have you hungover? We'll come around.
So, yeah, I don't get to enjoy my hangover now until 7 p.m. when my daughter's gone to bed. And so you're kind of... Your whole day is building. It builds, and I know I'm going to get a curry because I always get a curry because I am, as I've established already, a total creature of habit. And so I look forward to this all day. And for all the kind of, you know, lovely meals I've been out for in my life, none fills me with joy as much as that experience of getting the Indian takeaway when I'm feeling hungover.
What do you order? What do you have?
Same thing every time, Alan. So my wife, she isn't veggie, but I am, and I've, over the years, broken her down because she wasn't eating enough of her chicken dish. So it's all veggie now. Because I was like,
good work.
You can't just have two spoonfuls of that. So we'll get garlic naan, probably 4 poppadoms with all the dips, then vegetable danzak, tarka dal, sag aloo, and then tikka paneer.
Chana masala?
Oh, I do like a chana masala. Well, they'll give us, do you know what? They give us a bonus dish as well if we go over £20 at my local one, which we do. And so I'll kind of change that between chana masala and bindi bhaji. And that's a kind of a wild card, that dish.
That is a wild card. That'll divide a room.
Yeah, but I'm happy to divide them because there's only 2 of us. So I'm more than happy to divide it.
Well, the joys of an Indian takeaway. I couldn't agree more. I love Indian food. I try and get my kids to eat it as soon as possible. If you get it down their neck early, they won't complain about it being too spicy, but later on.
Yeah. Do you know, I've got this thing as well where I always presumed I didn't like spicy food because I'm essentially a bit of a kind of weed and like not really into, you know, I'm not a like lad, but actually I'm really into spicy food and I always have been, but I just have presumed I haven't because it's not, doesn't work with my personality type, if that sounds like, that sounds such a weird thing to have.
Just keep a jar of chili flakes in the cupboard, you could always spice it up. Yeah. Put on your corn flakes in the morning.
Jamie Oliver has chili on his breakfast because he said it gives him a hit. That's one of the few things I've ever picked up from someone saying on the last leg that stuck with me.
Are you sure he didn't say it gives him the shit? Sounds more likely.
That does sound more likely.
Well, your favourite food is an Indian takeaway, and I cannot say I blame you. Let's move on to your film choice. You've chosen Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is a 2004 film, I think, by Charlie Kaufman, starring Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet. What is it about that one that gets you?
I think it's, I think what I like is it has a lot of things that kind of appeal to me about films in one place, in that it's got, I'm a sucker for a kind of indie sensibility to not just films, to kind of music or anything really. And on top of that, I think a high concept movie is always a pleasure. Do you know the classic kind of elevator pitch movie style thing? That's always thrilling. And when that is made to work, whether that be this or whether that be The Truman Show or whether that be Groundhog Day.
So if you haven't seen it, listener, this film is a couple played by Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet who have a relationship, break up, and then there's a company that offers you the chance to have the memory of your doomed and failed relationship erased.
Yes.
And they both take this option.
Yeah.
And then the film unravels into a kind of a mixture of their memories and the real event, and you're with them, with Jim Carrey, while his memory's being erased and he's in and out of it. And it's a lot of time shift being played with. Kate Winslet dies a hair about 10 times in the film, which kind of helps you root where you are in the time.
You get the feeling that the hair dye has come as a late note on the script to, in some way, say, could we have some kind of visual signifier to help people understand
help where the hell we are in the story. I should confess that this film, I mean, I'm a big fan of Charlie Kaufman, a big fan of adaptation and being John Malkovich. This film I remember being disappointed by because I'd seen a trailer for it. And in the trailer, they do a montage of a sequence. Jim Carrey is one of the most brilliant comedians in the history of cinema.
Yeah.
They do a montage sequence to Mr. Blue Sky by ELO, the single most upbeat pop rock track's ever been played. A song that no one dislikes.
That's quite a claim.
And I'm in the cinema watching this, and Mr. Blue Sky's playing. There's Jim Carrey doing this stuff. I think this is going to be hilarious. It's so upbeat that anyway, it turns out to be quite a maudlin, sad, but wry and intelligent and clever film. Mm. With a brilliant performance by Kate Winslet, in which Jim Carrey is almost not funny really at all.
No, you wanting him to do a bit more gurning?
I was furious. I wanted Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. I wanted somebody stop me. You know, I wanted this guy. Where,
so you were watching this thinking I preferred Liar Liar, is what you were thinking.
The cable guy. So he's obviously taken the part to show his range. He's shrunk himself down to a kind of sensitive guy. Does it well enough. But on second viewing, also I didn't know... And I didn't know where the title came from. I didn't know it was a quote. I've never heard of Alexander Pope. It's a quote from an Alexander Pope poem from the 18th century, which is how to paraphrase this. It's about a couple who are in love and then they reconnect 20 years later. It's about lost love being rediscovered. Mm. And that's kind of what the film is about too, isn't it? So it's a kind of a reference there for you in the title if you know it, but they don't really play on it.
No. I mean, it's, at its essence, it's a romantic comedy in a weird way, in the sense of it's a story about a couple, and for one, it's almost like, despite that kind of almost science fiction premise that they both go and get their memories erased, you then get this kind of meditation on what it means to have, into what a relationship means to you, and what it's like to go back through all the memories of the relationship, and what a relationship's worth to you. And then obviously you get, I won't spoil the ending, but it's very neatly brought together at the end, and there's kind of some, you know, interesting decisions made without trying to be a spoiler on it.
There are. And also there's this quite odd little side thing going on. Well, while they're doing this thing to Jim Carrey, Kirsten Dunst and Mark Ruffalo are engaged, having a kind of a new fledgling relationship of their own, around him while he's asleep. It's very odd, different layers of storytelling going on. And she's the one who brings up Pope Alexander, she calls him.
Yes.
In a throwaway line in the middle.
And she's, Tom Wilkinson plays a very good kind of, there's like lots of extra interesting kind of subplots going on. I think the thing with it is, you know, it's beautifully shot because it's Michelle Gondry and it's beautifully shot. It looks great. You know, I suppose, along with my music choice and a weird way with the choice of the traditional family holiday, I do just quite enjoy that kind of maudlin sensibility, it turns out. You know, that's where I kind of like to... I suppose the same with sitting having an Indian hungover. That's where I like to disappear to.
we'll have an Indian. We'll listen to Kings of Convenience. Then we'll watch Eternal Sunshine.
By the way, have I told you about the failure of Gus Caesar? Do you know, like, it's like...
Have I told you that all optimism is pointless? Nothing's going to go well for you. Yes. I'm going to choose to decide that you're quite grounded, and that's why. Well, it's a good film. It's a better film for me the second time around because I was really thrown off by the trailer, and it really should be illegal to use an upbeat pop song in your trailer if it doesn't feature in the film.
Do you think, well, they've literally, what they've done is they've gone, sunshine, spotless mind, right, it's kind of blue sky, that'll do. They've typed blue sky into Spotify or whatever and they've come up with it. They haven't. That's how they've made the trailer.
They've definitely outsourced the trailer to another company.
Yeah.
I've been dying to use this ELO song. Have you ever heard of ELO? It's an amazing newest band I've found. I've been dying to use this song. We'll use it on this. And then they lure in the Jim Carrey fans. It was a kind of an odd pairing, Jim Carrey and Kate, was it? But they're both very, 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 very good in the film.
I think they're both kind of playing against type and, like, this is great performances in it. I met Mark Ruffalo on Graham Norton and he was an absolutely lovely bloke. And and I was like, you know, when you're like, oh, I reckon I could be mates with him. And then I went on his Wikipedia and it said he's a 9/11 truther. And I thought, I'm not really into this anymore.
Well, I'm very familiar with him because my kids are making me go through all of the Avengers films lockdown. And I held on for a while because they're not old enough for this certificate. But then I caved. Now the four-year-old's going around the house pretending to be Spider-Man. it's a wonderful film. Thank you for that, Josh. Well, we've just really got One last thing. It's been fascinating to hear you talk about all these different things, which is a memory. Before we move on to your memory, I want to, for listeners who are, want to find an email to address a mistake made earlier, Paul Newman was the star of The Hustler, not Steve McQueen, as it's written in Nick Hornby's brilliant book, Fever Pitch. It was, of course, the fantastic Paul Newman. So let's talk about your favourite memory then.
So this was a memory. So it was kind of, it's not necessarily like my favourite memory in the sense of child being born, but it was like, I think it was, I was just thinking of a memory is kind of where you disappear to or something that kind of represents something for me. And I was thinking about driving through Derbyshire on my last tour. Let's be honest, Alan, being driven. And we, you know, let's make no bones about having a tour manager. And it was.
Are you in the passenger seat up front or are you in the back of a big van?
Passenger seat up front.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man of the people.
Just the two of you?
Just the two of us. But there's usually a support, but there was a different, there is a support, but there was a different support between these two gigs. So there was no one in the car except us. And it was the first day after the tour, the first night of this tour that I'm currently doing. That is currently on indefinite hiatus at the time of podcast.
Ouch.
And often on tour, you know, you're going from one place to the other and, you know, it's the same old, or it's before a tour, or it's before a piece of work and you're worried about it and it's, you know, you don't know whether it's good, you don't know whether it's bad, you're putting in all the effort and it's really stressful. And the first night of the tour had gone well and I kind of liked the show, which is not always the case. I'm sure you kind of understand.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like it just was a strange moment in working where it felt like I didn't feel under pressure anymore. And I felt like I'd done this show I liked, this tour show I liked. And we were driving through the kind of beautiful Peak District. And it reminded me very much of, I don't know if you're aware of the artist Mr. Bingo.
No.
So he's like this very good kind of artist, does funny art from East London.
I've found his website, Mr. Bingo, artist, speaker and twat, it says.
Yeah, that's him. So, and that sums up the kind of, so he does, he's got this piece of art which is called the Anxiety Circle, right? And it's basically a large circle, like a roundabout, and I'd say 95% of it is one colour and it's labelled underlying anxiety about the next thing, and then the other 5% is that thing being fine, and then it goes back onto the other 95%, which is underlying anxiety about the next thing. And that kind of sums up my life of doing stuff, in that I'm constantly anxious about the next thing, and then there's that small moment when you do it and you're like, oh god, it was fine after all, and then something else comes along and you're anxious. And that driving through after the first gig of the tour and thinking, this is going to be all right. This show's really fun and good and I like it. I had a good night last night. And it's so rare that I get that, where I'm not worrying about something in my kind of life, that stands out to me as a real moment. And it also was so, if you've not been to the picture, it's so beautifully picturesque. It was overcast.
It is a gorgeous part of the world.
Yeah, as you can imagine, overcast appeals to me with the mood I've kind of given in this podcast.
Were you going to the Buxton Opera House?
I was going to the Buxton Opera House.
Yeah.
You know that the Buxton Opera House is such a beautiful venue that you're going to have a great night.
Yeah, lovely.
And that was like one of those times when you're like, I need to remember this. I vividly remember thinking, I need to remember this because this is going to, you know, it's not always like this. And this is a real moment of like, I'm pleased with what I'm doing and what I've done, and I'm kind of happy in this moment.
You know what you can do? And I think it's Paul McKenna who does this. Who's the hypnotist guy who makes people give up smoking?
Yeah, that's him.
You get your tip of your fourth finger and your thumb, and you touch them together, and then you think of a special moment.
Right.
For you, it could be that.
Yeah.
And you think of that moment, and then from now on, whenever you touch the tip of your finger to your thumb, that moment will come back to you.
Oh, wow.
And I'm telling you this, it works.
Really?
It works. And that's a lovely memory, and I know exactly what you mean.
Have you got memories there then, Alan?
I've got something there. It's in a swimming pool in Spain. It's not dirty. But it was a moment on the family holiday. But I have one, yeah. And once you pick one, it's very difficult to change it. You'll have to have a different finger.
Yeah. You've got 10 different memories.
10 different memories. Mr. Bingo's got an online supermarket and you can buy a print of the Anxiety Circle for £75.
He's an absolutely brilliant artist. Just everything he does is so kind of funny and original. So I've got like, we've got like loads of kind of things he's done. I'd advise everyone to check him out. He did one for Valentine's Day, which is a picture of four different couples kissing with just the word c*** written on it. He's really good.
I'll tell you, while I think of it, speaking about the Buxton Opera House, I usually, if I'm doing a stand-up gig, I'll have a little table which will have my set list on it because I can't remember anything. And also it'll have a bottle of water, and I had Buxton water on the table, which was provided by the venue.
Of course.
And I made some remark about the Buxton water, and that you really can get something going in Buxton if you talk about spring water. They are very proud.
I bet.
Of their water. I mean, I just want to say something. It's not like the Champagne region of France, is it? It's not really something that you could say this sort of pride in. This is ridiculous. It's water. It's the best, okay?
Yeah.
It's the best bottled water in the land. And it is exceptional. It's not denying.
I don't know whether I could taste test it.
It's the perfect combination of hydrogen and oxygen.
Is that
molecules.
Right?
They've really nailed that. I mean, it's hardly the Coca-Cola secret formula, but they bottled it. They have literally bottled it.
It's so nice, Buck. Like, those theatres which you go to, they're called Matcham Theatres that are designed in such these kind of...
Yes, by Matcham.
Astonishing Victorian theatres are just so amazing to get to play. I did Buxton once and my sound went, like the mic went or whatever. It didn't make any difference. Do you know what I mean? They could just hear you because it was designed to...
Yes,
to be heard. And you go, I don't quite understand how we've got to this situation where theatre design has gone backwards in the last 100 years, but that seems to be the kind of case.
Well, people like to change things, don't they? It's one of those venues where it's nice to play and it's nice to sit in the audience too. It's just a nice place to be, rather like the Hackney Empire. Wonderful. Similarly, a Matcham Theatre. Well, Josh, we're at the end. We're at the end of your seven pillars. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. I think what I found quite interesting is... unknowingly, I've worked out that my favourite things are feeling a bit down. Do you know what I mean? Or feeling a bit kind of melancholic. A lot of...
But you've embraced the melancholy rather than fight it. And that this may be why you come across as a much more contented person than you actually are.
Yeah. It's all part of the mask.
It's all part of the mask. Josh Widdicombe, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.